Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The purpose of Memorial Day is to honor those who have gone and those who have served. But here's a different remembrance of a time nearly a half century ago near Haworth, Illinois, where the incident at Kickapoo Creek happened. GLT's John Norton has more in an encore presentation of this story about a Midwestern version of the Woodstock Music Festival.
On Memorial Day weekend in 1970, an estimated 60,000, mostly hippies and college-age students, invaded the village of Haworth, Illinois, population 1,200.
The newspaper said this hippie tide hits Haworth. That was an accurate description.
Town was like a zoo.
They descended on this small McLean County town to attend a rock festival named Incident at Kickapoo Creek.
I remember like REO Speedwagons, those type of groups. What I remember most about the music at Kickapoo Creek was probably a couple of the big name bands.
And three of those big bands were Canned Heat, Country Joe and the Fish, and the Butterfield Blues Band, all who had played Woodstock 9 months prior. B.B. King was there, as was Ted Nugent.
A group called Smith.
Michael McDonald, he had a band from St. Louis.
The Who was going to be there.
Were the Beatles going to be there? Were the Beatles going to get back together?
I'd like to do a song now just dedicated to everybody that's here today.
Though it is still one of the largest, if most infamous, events ever to be held in McLean County, it's almost as if, officially, it never happened.
There isn't a whole lot written about this thing, and it really has taken this long to tell the story accurately.
That's Normal native R.C. Raycraft. He's a producer by trade, with credits including the Discovery Channel and the BBC. He says even 25 years after the festival, the village of Haworth was giving him and his fledgling movie a cold shoulder.
Going in 95, 2000 to go meet with the board at Haworth to see if we could do something with Kickapoo, and it was like going to the parole board.
The board, you mean city council?
The city council.
Okay.
For those years, I knew that it was going to be like trying to get parole, and that they didn't want to have anything to do with it, and they were embarrassed by it.
The townsfolk boarded up the windows and locked up their children and were very, very frightened because the hippies are coming, the hippies are coming.
I get high all day. I feel fine.
Raycraft's interest in the incident at Kickapoo Creek Festival began as a teen. He was intrigued by a poster of the festival given to him by his father. His interest grew when he acquired a bootleg vinyl of the stage show. The aha moment came when he was in his 20s. He was working as a producer of police shows, similar to Cops in Champaign-Urbana.
There was a guy that owned a production company that transferred films to video. One night while I was waiting to cut my programs, he was finishing up transferring films, and there were three rolls of three-minute films of the incident at Kickapoo Creek.
But the film that caught his attention wasn't a documentation of what happened on stage. Raycraft was viewing police video, but I'm getting a bit ahead of myself.
We're not really ready to play yet. Y'all had a good time so far, though?
The incident at Kickapoo Creek Rock Festival was the brainchild of Bloomington's L. David Lewis, whose family owned a farm outside of Haworth. Raycraft says Lewis saw what happened at Woodstock and attempted to recreate it in McLean County.
Oh, I think that he saw financially that if they would have done a couple things differently, they could have made a lot of money, and he took advantage of the weaknesses of Woodstock as far as it being a free festival and monetized it.
I will always
Paul Welch was the McLean County State's attorney at the time, and he was not amused with what Lewis was attempting to pull off, so he filed an injunction against Lewis a day before the concert. When Lewis moved forward with the festival, a festival that included a motorcycle gang as security,
Paul Welch sent in two undercover officers from Normal to record all of the wild and bizarre happenings that took place.
Kickapoo Rock Festival, which was pretty exciting to be at. One reason, of course, was because of all the naked people.
How many people? I think we're around 60,000 strong.
The police video became instrumental to Raycraft's movie about the incident at Kickapoo Creek, and he says it was Welch who later helped him acquire other evidence still in storage.
This was years later. There was a box inside of the state's attorney's office in the closet when I approached him about it, he said, you know, this box is here. You know, this whole closet, we're waiting to get the next intern because we're going to throw all this away. So if there's anything in here you want, take it.
So Raycraft took the boxes and said one of them had exactly what he was looking for, including paperwork, film, and the basic skeleton of the story.
And I think the reason it was all there is because the promoter left. So they had all the evidence, but they never used it against him in court because he disappeared and they tried him in absentia.
With police film and paperwork in hand, Raycraft knew he had something special. And he realized the real story of the festival was offstage, partially because there wasn't a whole lot of film of what happened on stage, but mostly because Raycraft was riveted by the dynamic between the gentleman farmer promoter, L. David Lewis, and McLean County State's attorney, Paul Welch.
And both made it clear in the newspaper, one, Welch, I'm going to stop the festival. Two, Lewis, the promoter, the festival's going on. Something was going to happen one way or the other.
And something did happen. I mean, the festival happened. The attorney had the farmer arrested.
At the bank, because he had a loaded .38 and a bag full of cash.
As soon as the rock festival was over, they said that he took off and went to Mexico.
There were scuttlebutt rumors that he'd taken all the money and hired a jet and went somewhere.
He might end up buried out in the desert.
It was rumored that he died, that he was dead.
Those who know the story know that 42-year-old Lewis made bail and left. He left his wife, he left his work, and his country. He left with the cash he made from the festival and with his teenage secretary.
The interesting thing about that is everybody talks about D.B. Cooper. David Lewis was the D.B. Cooper of rock and roll a year before D.B. Cooper, and Lewis took off with more cash than D.B. Cooper did, and never got caught and lived to tell the story.
Raycraft says Lewis eventually returned to the United States, and he eventually tracked him down.
Yeah, that's something that's the fourth act of my film that I don't really like to go into great detail about because you got to have that fourth act twist in any noir documentary.
Is this new to the showing, or this showed in 2010 as well?
I've always brought the promoter in, but not as slap in your face as I did this time.
Okay, so that is different.
Well, there's a lot of animosity between those guys. They hated each other's guts.
Now, Raycraft had a storyline to go along with the bootleg vinyl of the stage show and the police video and evidence of what happened offstage. The only thing missing? The principals to tell their side of the story.
And the smartest thing that I ever did regarding this project is I asked everybody the same questions. You don't always get the same perspective, but you get the same answers.
So you can get people sort of talking to each other that weren't talking to each other?
You know, that's the magic in the film is, yeah, people start talking about something and then somebody else talks about the same thing and it's just like people are having conversations on film.
My name is Dave Lewis. I am the promoter of the infamous incident at Kickapoo Creek.
Mr. Lewis, if you'd have done it right and in accord with the best interests of the public in general, you might have been able to make your money without...
The film for Incident at Kickapoo Creek has been shown in Central Illinois every 5 years, beginning in 1995. Raycraft says by tinkering over the years and being able to transfer the original police tape to high definition has allowed the movie to evolve and improve.
There are a lot of things that I missed in the past because I was working off of a working copy. When you start over from scratch with something, a lot of light bulbs go off because you find these hidden jewels.
Are you talking about technology? Or are you talking about the interviews or the storytelling itself?
The technology is what it is, but character development certainly has changed a lot, which has really been great for the story because you feel for these characters. You like them one way or the other. The movie's a Western, okay? There's the good guys and the bad guys. And I present it where you, the audience, get to choose who's the good guys and who's the bad guys.
John Norton reporting on the incident at Kickapoo Creek with documentary filmmaker R.C. Raycraft. This story originally aired on Sound Ideas in 2016.
You gotta do yourself a favor, you gotta chase all your blues away. Well, now you got to smoke your reefer, well, you gotta have a chance today. Or well, you take two puffs, well, you know that you're gonna get high. Well, now it don't make no difference just as long as you're as high as the sky.
Support for GLT comes from Fox & Hounds Hair Salon and Day Spa, surrounding you with care and attention from head to toe, providing a full range of hair, nail, and massage services for men and women. 200 West Monroe in downtown Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a moment, the Illinois Politics Roundtable gets down to it as the legislature prepares to get down to the last week of the spring session. Also for Memorial Day, the respect this country shows veterans for their service in time of war has increased in recent years on a variety of fronts. One such marker is the Land of Lincoln Honor Flights. It's based in Springfield and is starting its 11th season of honor flights in central Illinois, taking vets to the nation's capital. There were 53 flights last year, taking 4,110 veterans to D.C. With us to talk about the program are Vietnam War veteran Larry Rigdon of Normal and program volunteer Kevin Lancaster.
For a lot of these veterans, getting out there, seeing those memorials is very important to them. It's for a lot of the guys, it's closure for their military careers, especially the Vietnam veterans, experiencing the Vietnam Wall. It's just all the memorials are important.
Larry Rigdon, you were on an honor flight, right?
It's just a great day for veterans that are qualified to go. And a lot of people tell me that they've been out there on their own, but it's so important, I think, for the veterans to go as a group with other servicemen. And it's just a good camaraderie day for them to experience being with their own peers.
Had you seen the wall before?
Never had. Well, the one here in town.
The moving wall.
Moving wall, I've seen, but I've never been to Washington, no, except till last August.
And how did it impact you?
It was just a really fun day, and I tell you, I really enjoyed all the walls. I mean, the monuments, the Korean, I think, is probably the best one. I think that they're kind of standing out in the field, you know, the statues And when you walk around in a circle, their eyes follow you around. I guess that's what you'd call it.
How do such monuments, whether it's Lincoln or the FDR Memorial or the World War II Memorial or Korea or the Wall, how do they create memories as well as allow you to experience the national heritage?
Oh, I think it's just a great deal for, to be able to remember that. I was really impressed by all that out there. It was really a great day to go with on the honor flight.
Tell us what you did in Vietnam.
I was a radio operator. I kind of had an interesting job over there. I directed our helicopters in. Our UAs and stuff in that brought supplies, you know, like food and ammo, and so we wouldn't shoot our own provided coordinates, and so they wouldn't shoot. We wouldn't shoot our own helicopters down. So that was a real important job, and I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
I would have thought that your experience of the wall would be more impactful than the Korean Memorial, and you're saying that you thought the Korean.
I mean, I liked the wall. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, I did. We had a friend over there that we found. Kevin and I found his name on there on the wall, and I didn't really know anybody on there, but you know, I liked the Vietnam Wall, but I think the Korean monument, or the Korean monument, was more, I don't know. It was just a feeling about it.
I saw it at dusk one year when I took the family out. My son was fairly young, and it was very powerful then because you see them coming out of the darkness as you walk up.
Sure. Out of
it. Why are memorials important? Kevin?
They're important just for all the sacrifices that these men have gone through. You know, the World War II guys, Korean veterans, they went through a lot too. And it's important for them to see these memorials.
How does the experience of these honor flights differ among the veterans from different wars?
We take generally 80 to 85 veterans on the trip. You know, it's just a different experience for them, you know.
So some will remember lost comrades. Some will remember good times with the comrades. Some will remember the conflict itself. Some will see the memorials and say, you know, the nation does value what we did for it.
Exactly.
But is that consciousness, that experience different from generation to generation?
You know, I think it is, and you can tell it too. We're taking, you know, the World War II guys are in their mid-90s now, you know, they're getting up there. Korean War veterans are getting up there,
not
too.
Not many left.
There's not many
World
left.
World War II.
And, but I think that has a big impact on it.
So it's the age of the veteran rather than the nature of the conflict that is that differs, that makes the experience different.
Yes.
So with the World War II and Korean veterans, the few that are left, what do they see? What do they say?
Well, they thought it was just great. I mean, they just have a great day out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those guys, it's very humbling to have the World War II veterans on these flights. They're pretty much the spotlight throughout the day.
They sit right at front of the bus, and, you know, they're first at everything. So. Yeah. Which is only right.
Mm-hmm. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Larry Rigdon, a Vietnam War era veteran, and Kevin Lancaster of the Honor Flight Program in this area of the state. How many veterans are eligible, do you think, and would benefit, would like to do this?
There's tons of veterans out there. We're reaching out to them. I have another gal that helps me out. We go around doing presentations, and we're having really good success at assisted living facilities here in Bloomington Normal. Obviously, if we can reach out to a World War II or a Korean War veteran and get them signed up, they're going to be going on their flight as soon as possible. We put those two war-era veterans at the top of the list.
How do you handle mobility and disability issues? How can that be made smoother?
Yes. We provide 50 to 55 wheelchairs. We take them with us from Springfield to D.C. There is wheelchair accessibility that day for them. Otherwise, it's a lot of walking.
Obviously, the memorials are an important and impactful point. What else happens?
We saw the changing of the guard, and we went to the Air and Space Museum.
At Arlington, you mean?
Yeah, no,
changing the guard.
Changing of the guard.
Okay.
And that's quite a place there, although you wouldn't believe how big that is and how many graves and monuments there are there. And Audie Murphy's grave is just like everybody else's, you know. I couldn't believe that he didn't have a big marker yet, but it's just like everybody else's.
Tomb of the Unknown.
He was the greatest. I think he had like 33 medals over there in World War II. I think the thing with the honor flight is that everybody that is involved in the honor flight, nobody gets a dime for doing anything. I mean, there's no, you know, the gal that runs it works out of her home in Springfield. And
aviation fuel costs money, accommodations cost money. How mm-hmm. there have to be some sorts of fundraising.
Yes, absolutely, Charlie. Throughout the year, there's fundraising going on, you know, 12 months out of the year. We have so many generous donors in the state. We do fundraising, benefits, merchandise sales. That's how we get our money. We are a nonprofit organization. We do not receive any state, federal, or government funding. It's all by volunteer work. We got over 300 volunteers in this organization.
In most wars, there are differences of opinion in the public about whether this was a worthy cause. World War II's the exception to that. How do the memories of the political times and the political sensibilities translate to today on these honor flights?
You know, when I went to Vietnam, you know, I think the perception's changed quite a bit now. I think it's a lot better now, and I think that, of course, the honor flights help too.
No, I agree with Larry. I think the perception has changed over time.
It's getting better.
We have had a long stretch of military conflict in recent years, too. Mm-hmm. When will these soldiers be eligible for honor flights? When will their time come to be memorialized?
Yeah, that's a good question. Obviously, we're running out of World War II veterans and Korean veterans.
They got to get a monument made first.
Absolutely.
They don't have anything out there yet.
The more flights we take, it's looking more like Vietnam veterans that we're serving. Currently, we have 800 on our waiting list, so it's approximately 2 years to get them guys going, but. You know, I see it down in the near future, within 5 years, I'm hoping. Could take a little bit longer than that, but certainly those veterans deserve to have memorials as well.
The nature of memorials changes from generation to generation. It's no longer the general on the high horse with the sword upraised. It's no longer a seated figure in triumph or dressed like a Roman victory thing. Mm-hmm. It's no longer even columns of the World War II memorial or the individual soldiers marching through the mist of the Korean memorial. It's the Vietnam memorial is a stark, contemplative, quiet place of names. Does the function of the shape of the memorial matter to the soldiers?
I don't think it does.
I don't think so. It's just the memories of it.
Yeah.
How did it help you, Larry Rigdon, revisit your memories of the war?
Oh, it just brought back a lot of memories when I was in Nam. So, you know, a lot of people try not to think about it. Some Vietnam veterans, well, World War II veterans do that, you know, or Korea, they don't want to talk about it, but I've never had a trouble talking about it. I mean, it was just a part of life. I mean, I was drafted. I didn't really want to go, but the country said I had to, so I went.
Kevin Lancaster, that point that Larry raised about, you know, some veterans have never talked about it since they came back, and yet they go on these flights, and maybe some of them start to talk about it, or some of them, like Larry, never had any difficulty talking about it. Would you discuss how people react to the flights and maybe change the way they've been handling
it? Absolutely. You know, I think it's when they get to their memorial. I've taken three Vietnam veterans. I think once they see these memorials, it's a closure for them.
What do they tell you?
My second Vietnam veteran, Jerry Liebenstein, when he saw his buddy's name on the wall, he was just relieved. He told me that day that he could finally be at peace.
A lot of the guys that went on the flight, I think they were more open when we were all together, you know, than being around strangers and stuff and being, I think they were more open to talk about things.
Well, how important is the shared experience or the shared brotherhood in creating an ease?
I think it's real important.
Absolutely. You know. Just being together, I think, for the day.
Yeah.
80
yeah.
veterans, 80 to 85 veterans, they just form a bond that day.
So what kinds of stories get shared?
Oh, we get some war stories told.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Sure.
Army food, rotten officers, what?
basic training, I think. Well, that was tough for me anyway. And the food, of course, over there, we know we just ate sea rations all the time, but never had hot meals very often. Had warm beer and hot meals.
Considerations. When we did get beer anyway, we didn't get it very often. But
Larry Rigdon, Kevin Lancaster, thanks so much for joining us
today. Well, thanks, Charlie, for having us.
Thanks, Charlie, for having us.
Each veteran is assigned a guardian for the honor flight.
Support for GLT's summer concert June 8th comes from Specs Around Town. Specs has been bringing exclusive, specialty, and designer eyewear to Central Illinois since 1998. Specs will be at summer concert alongside Rebirth Brass Band and headliner Adia Victoria. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a Story Slam story presenting a unique side of Jack Waddell. One more week. That's all that's left in the spring legislative session. And the Illinois Politics Roundtable notes there's a passel of issues still under negotiation. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, Hannah Meisel of the Daily Line, and Greg Hines with Crane Chicago Business. We begin with the budget, the largest unresolved item. Brian Mackey catches us up.
The legislature is still pushing ahead with this graduated income tax. Of course, that doesn't have anything to do with the current year's budget, other than serving as sort of a convenient dodge to be able to say, well, this budget doesn't have to be, you know, as balanced as we might otherwise like it, because we're just building a bridge to the future when we'll have all this additional revenue from a graduated income tax. That's moving ahead. Lawmakers are still working out the details on other aspects of a state spending plan. I'm told that a lot of potential revenue increases are still in the mix, despite the big infusion of extra cash that came in April, $1.5 billion. People are calling the April surprise, and some additional revenue is expected to continue into next year because of that unexpectedly higher taxes. But Democrats say we still might need more revenue, still looking at some of these. The bag tax, though, as one example, is something that I've heard, Majority Leader Greg Harris said, not faring so well in terms of attracting support in the General Assembly.
And Greg, what are you hearing behind the scenes at this point?
Well, there is indeed some jostling back and forth over legalizing marijuana and whether we can count on that as a revenue source, and in sports betting. One of the groups during the week actually, there's kind of an intramural fight amongst the gambling folks. One group was going to launch a $1 million campaign against another group. They pulled their ads at the last minute. But that adds a little bit of uncertainty. But if you step back and look at the wider thing, I think we're much closer to a budget than we have been for several years in a lot of ways. The Democrats know they have to get this done. There's a little bit of division about exactly what the mix is going to be, but I think the generalities are pretty likely.
Well, of course, J.B. Pritzker wants many of these things, and Hannah, the Democratic-controlled legislature is not going to, in his first term, leave him hanging, are they?
I don't think anyone wants to do that. That wouldn't do anything for unity within the Democratic Party. I mean, they just got the governor's office back after a really tough 4 years for them. But I mean, you know, it's interesting. We're talking about the budget, but it's after 4 years of under Rauner, the budget was the main thing that everyone fought about. But you know, there are now all of these side issues that are really proxy wars for the budget, but that's what is gaining all the attention. I am hearing that the budget is just not going to be a big deal. People are probably going to be happy to vote for, you know, whatever, and it's these other, you know, more sexy promises, things that the governor promised on the campaign trail, a graduated income tax. Cannabis, you know, it would really be an embarrassment for the governor's office if they can't get cannabis done before May 31st.
Charlie, they're not going to, as I mentioned before, they're not going to leave the governor hanging most likely, but something could drop off the table that could impact the budget, how much money there is to spend. What's your thought going, a week out?
Well, from what I can see, and I'm obviously not down there every day talking to these people, but from what Brian said about what Representative Harris, it seems to me that the plastic bag tax might be the first thing to go. I don't remember exactly how much it was supposed to bring in, somewhere in the neighborhood of, what, $10, $12 million? And it strikes me that for all the grievance that they're going to get when people go to the grocery store and have to pay extra, that's pretty small change in terms of the overall budget picture. And the fact that the revenues spiked so much in April means that they'll also have additional money to spend next year than what they thought when the governor proposed his budget. It's possible that something like the bag tax could go and not make any difference.
One thing that seems really iffy right now to your question, Sean, is how the capital bill is going to pan out. The governor's office last Friday introduced a $41.5 billion capital plan. Of course, that's not all state money. That's, you know, a significant amount is federal. However, it's a what you'd call both horizontal, which is roads and bridges, and vertical, which is buildings and infrastructure. And right now it seems like, I mean, everyone sees the need for roads and bridges, but vertical is just a much heavier lift. And we are seeing a bunch of groups, you know, hire lobbyists over the last weekend, or, you know, a couple days. And there's this massive, massive lobbying effort against all of these new taxes that have been included in
the
capital plan
that would
fund vertical.
Yeah, I think Hannah is right about that. The core budget, I think, is in good shape. I'm not willing to bet yet, though, that the capital bill is going to pass, because I don't know about you folks, but I've been hearing from lobbyists and lobbying groups, and, this maybe passes tax, Western Civilization is going to collapse about every 20 minutes. There indeed is some fire there, and I'm yet to be convinced that the legislature is going to suck it up and pass the stuff nonetheless.
And Greg, when it comes to an infrastructure plan, there's no doubt that there's some need out there, but from a lawmaker perspective, they always want that close to the election, it seems. They want to be able to have those projects they can announce. Even if the projects aren't done, they can announce they're coming. So to some extent, if this does get pushed off a bit, next year is still a likely possibility, even with some of these different taxes being talked about to pay for it.
Yeah, that's a real possibility. But if I'm a lawmaker and I've got to run for a new term, I think it's equally important for me to be able to have certainty. You know, if the votes are there now and I can definitely lock in that new highway interchange or that new bridge now, there's no good reason for me to postpone. At least that's if I were in leadership or if I were in Pritzker's camp. That's the argument I would make.
Yeah, and to me, that's the key. Unlike a lot of other programs for which lawmakers will appropriate money that don't produce results that are immediately visible to the community, if I'm a lawmaker and I vote, say, to raise the gasoline tax, and I can go home and say, yeah, you're going to be paying more cents at the gallon, but on the other hand, that road that's mostly potholes, now it's going to be mostly road. And if I have projects like that that I can trot out, it makes it easier for me to explain my vote. And it makes it harder for people to criticize me. Somebody criticizes me, and I can say, oh, you like the potholes? You want to keep the potholes?
But, Brian, this is also an opportunity for Pritzker to do some horse trading and say, hey, maybe we can get this project in here if you vote for this marijuana or this gambling package or something else. He can use a capital plan to get the votes needed on these other issues, right?
Yeah, that's the traditional way it's done. You have these earmarks. You have people who want this, whatever it is, a bridge in their district, an interchange, as Greg said. Although you also have this force this year pushing for a more data-based, sort of merit-based infrastructure building. And our colleague Mary Hansen has been doing some reporting on this. That story is still forthcoming. But you know, that is sort of at odds with the idea of letting members pick and choose the projects they want, and it might cut into the horse trading. Part of the goal with the capital advocates here is to get away from the sort of one-time revenue sources, and they want to move to what they're calling a more sustainable model. So the gas tax would potentially doubling or more in some of the proposals we've seen, but it would also potentially be indexed to inflation, so it would go up over time, and you would get out of this sort of boom and bust building cycle where you pass a capital plan in the past. It's been every 5 years. Now it's been 10 years since we've had one. So this is something where they think that, you know, they want to put Illinois on what they call a more sustainable path. It just complicates things a little further, though.
Let me move on to the issue of gambling. And Hannah, I know you've been covering that as well. At least some of the proposals we've seen to add casinos, we've seen the idea of sports gambling, sports betting being available, and the state would make money off of that as well. Where do we stand with that right now?
The language for it seems like it's going to be a big omnibus bill, Senate Bill, I believe 516. There's a hearing on that Monday Memorial Day, 8:30 in the morning. So pray for us. And, you know, but I think people, I've talked to a lot of people this week. They're very upbeat. They say that it feels different this year. And I think that's mostly because the governor's office is open to all forms of gaming because they've looked at the budget shortfall and they've pretty much made the calculation that we can take any help we're going to get. So for casinos, the plan right now would be to add 6 new casino licenses in the state, change the existing racetracks in the state, the 3 racetracks, to what they're called racinos, which, of course, have traditional horse racing but also table games, and then also the ability to move Illinois' 10 existing casinos to on land, and also to pick up and move anywhere that they want. So if the casino in Alton is not doing well and the owner decides, you know, we can't really do Alton anymore, then they can pick a new city, or a new city can recruit that company and say, please come here, and then we'll share, they'll have a revenue sharing agreement. And then, of course, sports betting, which is what the governor had prioritized in his budget address in February. He said, you know, don't let this be a Christmas tree kind of thing. Please separate out sports betting so we are guaranteed to get that, because in the year since the U.S. Supreme Court said that sports betting is legal, you know, a handful of other states, I believe it's like 7, 8, 9, something around that area, they have all legalized sports betting, and there's a race to get there. And then, of course, there's a race to the, you know, against the underground black market offshore betting.
Hannah mentioned all those casino additions, expansions, you want to call it. Greg, one of those would be the city of Chicago?
Yes. Our new mayor has put down a marker here. She said that, hey, if you're going to really expand gambling, I really want a casino in my town. A city-owned casino, which may be a bit of a hard sell down there. Her argument has been that while she doesn't like gambling in theory, that in reality, all kinds of Chicagoans on the south side just drive over the Indiana border and go there, and they take a lot of money with them, and there's no reason why that money shouldn't be spent here to support our services. So she said that if that passes, she'd like to be part of it.
And can you clarify, Greg, why a city-owned casino would be a hard sell to some lawmakers?
Well, one is strictly money. If it's a city-owned casino, presumably the city gets more, and the state and other portions of the state get less. Two, that's something that no other area of the state has, and all the other riverboats are owned by private companies rather than municipality. So there's an equity issue. Hey, we couldn't cash in. And three, to be perfectly honest, there's some suspicion that, you know, crooked old Chicago, where half the city council's gone to the poker in the last 25 or 30 years, how can we trust them to actually run a casino? The city's response to that is, well, we're going to have this layer of protection and all kinds of stern laws and reform, whatever, but there's going to be some skeptics.
That's Greg Hines with Crane Chicago Business. Also on the Illinois Politics Roundtable are Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, Hannah Meisel of the Daily Line, and moderator Sean Crawford. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, button, button, who's got the button? Or in one case, hundreds of thousands of buttons. People play with multiple identities. What is our real self? How do we present that one and all the other shades of self, from work to family to recreation to parties to parenting? That was a theme in a recent Next to Normal Story Slam produced by Devin Lovell. Story slams involve personal stories told by the heart and from the heart. Jack Waddell says his story is Color Me German, Bloomington to Berlin and back.
I'm Rosie, I'm Rosie, gemütlichkeit. Rose!
Guten Abend, liebe Freunde. Wir machen eine Reise nach Deutschland. Wir reisen nach München, nach Berlin, nach Hamburg, nach Frankfurt und natürlich auch nach Düsseldorf. I'm inviting you to make a trip with me to Germany. 10 minutes, right? It's going to be a fast trip. Backstory. 1959, I graduated from Bloomington High School. In my senior year, I was injured on the football field, carried off of the field, and you might say, in fact, that was my first Bloomington slam. What am I going to do, right? What am I going to do? I'm graduating. I was in the last graduating class in Bloomington High School, in the old high school, Washington Street. And my mentor, Mary Salk, some of you may know her, the choral director at the high school, she's 96 and still mentoring me. A family known, very affectionately known as Sarge. Well, Sarge steps up and said, what are you going to do? You're going to sing. I said, okay. Well, I was grateful because I'd inherited this basso profundo from my father, and I'd always wanted to sing. Sang in the church choir, sang at Bloomington High School. And Henry Charles, the head of the vocal department at Illinois Wesleyan University, said also, yes, sir, you're going to sing. I thought, yeah, right. My first voice teacher, my very good friend, Henry Charles, who gave me lessons when I had no money to pay, he said, come out, you're going to mow my lawn, you're going to wash my windows, but you're going to learn how to sing. Very grateful to Henry Charles. In fact, fast forward, I did attend. He got me a scholarship at Illinois Wesleyan University. And I would venture to say we were less than 5 African-Americans there at the university at that time. I liked Illinois Wesleyan University. I was a little bit behind because most of the students there have had 10 years of piano and violin and all this sort of thing. And I said, well, I played football, you know? And so, and anyway, fast forward, in my sophomore year, they were doing a production of Showboat. And some of you may know Chance Conklin. Right across the street, they were doing a production of Showboat, and he knew my professor, Henry Charles, and he said, I'm looking for a Joe. This guy's got to sing Old Man River. Charles said, well, he said, I've got a student that just won the McLean County Fair contest, and guess what? He was singing. So Chance came and he heard me, and I did. So that's where I began my career, right across the street. At that time, it was known as the consistory. My junior year, I did my first opera at Illinois Wesleyan, and it was Don Giovanni sang the role of Leporello. Went very, very well. And if any of you are familiar with Mozart's Giovanni, it's one of the most difficult operas to perform. The recitative requires practically fluent Italian to be able to perform that, and I did it very, very well. Unfortunately, the German class I was taken suffered. And I can remember Herr Bettger, a native German, he came backstage and said, Herr Waddell, he said, Sie sind fabelhaft. Sie haben ein perfektes Italienisch gesungen, aber leider muss ich dich durchfallen lassen in German. Translation, Herr Waddell, complimentary, your Italian was impeccable, was perfectly. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to fail you in German. Well, going on, I had to attend ISU and make up that course. The only course that I failed when I was at Illinois Wesleyan University. So now, in my senior year, Hank said, John, we have to have the talk. It was 1963. I was just about ready to graduate my last semester. And he said, you're going to have to get some education courses, you know, because you're going to be teaching, you know, in Pekin, Illinois, junior high school, high school. I said, yeah, Pekin, right? We had a laugh. We played Pekin in football, and I've never heard the N-word so much in all my life. I said, yeah, right, Pekin. No, in truth, though,
I was getting a Bachelor of Performing Arts in voice. I aspired to be an opera singer. Hank Charles informed me, he said, well, Jack, let's keep it real. He said, that's right. He said, in 1963, he said, you're a black man, you're not going to sing opera in America. I was stunned to think that he let me go 4 years, get my degree in Bachelor of Performing Arts, performing vocal, and he said, you're not going to do it here. I adamantly said, well, then I'll go to Germany. Well, they laughed. Fast forward, everyone, they were laying bets down on us. They said, well, John's going to Germany. He flunked German, you know, here at Tony. He's going to Germany. I didn't let it stop me. I was adamant. I said, well, Hank, you know, Germany has more opera houses per capita than any other country in the world, and that remains to be true today. I said, I'm going to go to Germany. I'm going to do it. Fast forwarding, after I graduated, I went to Washington, D.C., sang in the Army Chorus there, spent a couple of years, and then I was going to pursue my dream, passion, this basso profundo that I had inherited from my father. I was going to finally make it a reality. So during the day, I substitute taught at Bell Vocational High School, and in the evening, I went to Blackbeard's restaurant on Connecticut Avenue and waited and saved my money. And I went to Germany. I landed in Frankfurt. It was 1967. When I got to Frankfurt, I went immediately to Bad Reichenhall. There, small burg, small village, right on the Austrian border. In fact, a stone throw away from Hitler's nest, where he went there to recuperate. And as a matter of fact, there was a Holocaust survivor who was being paid to do tours up to Hitler's nest. The Goethe Institute is equivalent to our Berlin Institute, and I thought, I got to get a handle on this German. And I'm not doing it because they told me I couldn't, because the bets were already out there. Roberta Flack in Washington, D.C. said, I'll give him 3 months. He'll be back to America with his tail between his legs. That was the kind of thing I was confronted with. But I wasn't doing it for her. I was doing it for me. And at the Goethe Institute in Bad Reichenhall, they locked you into dormitories 5 hours a day. They gave you homework, tests, speaking classes, everything. And I thought, I just graduated. I'll be darned if I'm going to do a ton of homework in here. And they were frustrated. But at night, I would sneak out of the dormitory, and I'd go to the beer halls. And I would dance with the Fräuleins. And in short, I learned German in the beer halls. And I heard my professor say one day, he said, das verstehe überhaupt nicht der Herr Waddell. He said, I just don't understand. He doesn't do any of his homework. He doesn't do any of his, he's failed all of his tests, but he speaks the best darn German in the whole school. And I did, and as a matter of fact, and my reputation preceded me. I went to the German beer halls, and I met people, and they said, you know, we have an orchestra here, right here in Bad Reichenhall. In fact, they have an orchestra, they have a stage theater, everywhere in Germany. No matter what the word, because the arts are subsidized. I repeat, the arts are subsidized. So the word got out, there's a black opera singer here, you know. I was approached by the conductor and said, yeah, would you like to sing on our program on Sunday? I said, yeah, what can you do? Well, I was one of the finalists in the Met Regional Contest in Washington, and I sung the aria of King Philip from Don Carlo. And I said, I will do that aria. And he said, okay, wonderful. Fast forward, Sunday, I sang Ella Jemima Moore. The Germans went crazy. I was home. When the Germans get excited at a concert, they yell, Zugabe, Zugabe, encore, encore, and sort of thing. And they run to the stage, and they stomp, and they carry on. And they demand, in fact, that you repeat the aria. Well, we hadn't anticipated such a reaction. And the conductor said, wiederholen Sie bitte, repeat the aria. So I had a trick up my sleeve. He began the orchestra, and this time I sang the aria in German. I had arrived. I've come full circle. But that's not the end of it. After graduating from Goethe Institute, I went right to Munich. And the first thing I did in Munich was write the spring of 1968, when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. I went to the America House, and I said to the consulate, I said, I want to do a commemorative concert to Dr. Martin Luther King, all Negro spirituals. They said, yes! I did it in Munich to rave reviews. That was my big break in Germany. They sent me to Munich, to Regensburg, to Nuremberg, to Frankfurt, to Hamburg, to Berlin. I made a name. And like I say, call me German. I was a German celebrity within a year. I was speaking very fluent German. The first TV show that I did, I'm out of time, so I'll make this. I see you, Reese. All right. I would be remiss if I didn't. This one's a last Color Me German anecdote. The first film that I did, the title was called Color Me German. And I'm at the opera in Cologne. Was it Dusseldorf? I don't remember. And I get a phone call, and who's on the line but my Illinois Wesleyan mentor and friend? Stage manager said, Herr Waddell, Sie haben einen Anruf aus Amerika. You have a phone call off America. Pick up the phone, and who was it? Harry Lovell. Harry called me, said, well, call me German. He said, you old black beast. We had that kind of rapport going on. And he said, I'm calling. He said, we just saw Calling Me German was picked up by NBC, You Speaking German, the film. Said, we would like to invite you back to Illinois Wesleyan and confer upon you the Outstanding Young Alum Award. It was then that I knew that I had come full circle. And I'm back here now substituting. She can tell you, at Bloomington High School, and I tell my the students all the time, don't let anyone tell you what you can't do. You can do in it. Follow your passion. Do it. I know I'm over time. I'm out of here. Don't care.
Jack Waddell told his story at a Next to Normal Story Slam produced by Devin Lovell at the McLean County Arts Center. The theme for the June 21st Story Slam is fatherhood. You can subscribe to the Next to Normal Story Slam podcast to find more great stories. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Most historical artifacts get tucked away in museums behind locked doors and thick glass. For some, the best piece of history fits in your palm and sits in a drawer at home. In this encore edition of GLT Story, Mary Cullen talks with button collectors who gathered in Bloomington Normal about the future of this increasingly rare hobby.
Lisa Schultz started as a reluctant button collector. The family collection passed down to her reached 10,000 by the time she turned 15. She wanted nothing to do with them at first.
There's a lot of art in the buttons, a lot of art that we don't see in the modern buttons that are in the fabric stores now, a lot of history in those buttons.
Scholes says most of the family button haul were ordinary shirt buttons with no collector value, but a hand-carved ivory button from India and the buttons from her great-grandmother's wedding dress hooked her. Years later, she would be president of the National Button Society. Scholes lives in Wisconsin, where she owns and operates Button Images, a button-dealing business with her husband. Her collection now tops 500,000 buttons. She brought them with her to Bloomington Normal in the Illinois State Button Society Annual Convention. Scholes is an old-school button collector. She shares her love for historical buttons with the collector just two tables down, Gary Brockman. They both have a collection of hand-painted buttons from the 1700s.
These are things from the 18th century. You're probably looking primarily at men's buttons here.
Brockman shuffles through his collection, explaining that men in that era would use these detailed works of art to adorn their coats. Women's buttons were more like the buttons we see today, small and purposeful.
After about 1820, it completely flip-flopped, and men's buttons became much more restrained, and women's buttons really came to the forefront of representing the art movements of the era, Victorian era, with wonderful buttons. But as far as price point goes, you're looking at things in the high hundreds and into the thousands.
Brockman started collecting in 1993. Today, he's lost count.
There are very few objects that you can hold in your hand where you can actually develop a collection that represents all of that amazing technological history and science and art history. Other than buttons, I mean, I just have never found anything that does it as thoroughly.
Some buttons have cartoons. Some portray scenes of war. He says his collection provides a handheld history of the modernization of Western art. And 21st century buttons are becoming more like their early ancestors every day. Delilah Davis is a lampwork artist. That's someone who works in glass. After years of making marbles, she tried her hand at button making. She calls it the modern button, with options that glow in the dark, sparkle, and appear 3D. It's a fresh take on buttons, but Davis says it mirrors buttons of the past in one way. They're used for fashion, not function.
When I first started, I was trying to make buttons, thinking about it as the fact that, you know, you'd put it on a shirt, so it'd have to be tiny. I couldn't do that because, you know, you can't make little ones. When you're a studio artist, you make big ones.
A hot commodity for purses and jackets, Davis says her buttons are also popular in competitions.
That's amazing. Did you see this?
It's a great tray.
Look at this. That is.
The old button.
Gary Brockman was one of those judges at the Illinois State Button Society convention. After holding hundreds of thousands of buttons, he says he just has a knack for knowing what's good.
I don't tire of looking at them. I don't tire of digging into the history. Just makes it come alive.
But Brockman says he's worried. Younger generations aren't interested in buttons.
I find myself wondering what's going to happen to these objects, which are such soulful objects, once this hobby, I don't want to say dies, because I don't think it ever will. I think there will always be people who are interested in it. But I guess that's sort of an open-ended question for me. Who's going to take care of all this stuff? I hope somebody steps up.
Brockman might have his answer, standing a few feet away. Stephanie Dyer is a sixth-generation button collector and vice president of the Mississippi Valley Button Club in Quincy, Illinois. She plays buttons with the best of them, but there's one thing that makes her stand out. At 33, she's the youngest collector in the room. Dyer says the family collection started with her great-great-grandpa.
I just had no idea that other people didn't grow up with this extreme variety of buttons.
As a new generation button collector, Dyer has some ideas about revitalizing the pursuit. She wants to hold a class on turning buttons into jewelry.
Most people don't have any idea the detail that goes into these buttons. You can spend anywhere from 5 cents to $3,000 on a button.
For Dyer, button collecting was a way of life, handed down from older generations. Other collectors aren't so lucky to find an heir. Lisa Schultz, the button collector from Wisconsin, says her children have no interest in her button collection. When she and her husband die, those 500,000 pieces of history risk being erased, leaving future generations in a museum looking at historical artifacts behind the glass. I'm Mary Cullen.
The Illinois State Button Society accepts new members from all generations. Find out how to join at IllinoisStateButtonSociety.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on this Memorial Day. With help today from John Norton, Mary Cullen, and Devin Lovell of the Next to Normal Story Slams. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can find all episodes and stories from the Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal, made possible with the help of listeners like you.